Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 18th day of March 2026. We welcome you to the program 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock, and we thank you for being here, as always. We love having you. It's a big part. You know, if you weren't around to listen, there's no reason for us to be here. So thank you for doing that, doing your part. And we will now attempt to do ours. We have a wonderful group assembled this morning. I'll introduce them in just a moment. Couple of notes here that I wanted to make mention of. First of all, coming up later this morning, we're going to talk to the actor Tim Matheson. Tim Matheson, who I am enjoying once again playing Vice President John Hoynes in The West Wing, and just a great role. And he's going to be with us this morning. He is in the seventh season of Virgin River. He has a memoir out, and we'll talk to Tim Matheson coming up at 11 o'clock. Yesterday, Tuesday, is normally our day for book picks. We had a wonderful interview with Melissa Oftemauer yesterday, and so we moved book picks to today. So we will welcome our booksellers from the Golden Notebook and Woodstock and Open Door Bookstore in Schenectady. They'll be with us, so a week will not go by without book picks this week. Also, I have been mentioning this, but I want to mention it again, that on Friday at 11 o'clock, for the full hour, we are going to welcome Dr. Ibram Kendi to the program. He is the author of the new book, Chain of Ideas, The Origins of Our Authoritarian Age. I just read a review of this in the New York Times. It wasn't a great review, but the book is much better than I thought the review was. But that's okay. That's fine. We all have our thoughts. This is how great replacement theory has moved from the margins to become the most dominant political theory of our time, according to Dr. Kendi. He will join us for a one-hour discussion on Friday morning. He'll be live, and we look forward to that talk on Friday. Moving to next week. As if there is not enough to do. And there really, is there ever enough to do? Ani DiFranco is going to be in our region and is going to be a part of the New York State Writers Institute and our Creative Life series that we've been doing with the Writers Institute for a really long time. And I say a really long time because it doesn't seem like a long time. But then they show pictures of all the events at the beginning. And I'm like, my God, I was like 8 when this started. How did that happen? So Ani DiFranco will be with us. And the new book is The Spirit of Ani, Reflections on Spirituality, Feminism, Music, and Freedom. It's a really glorious book and just a great moving of the spirit. And I think you'll enjoy it. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. That event is free, open to the public, Page Hall, downtown campus of Albany, 7:30 on Tuesday night. And we would love to have you with us. And so stop on by. We'd love to have you there. We will be taping it for later broadcast, but we would love to have you in the room where it happens, as they say. So I think that is all I have for news. Let's go on to introduce the group here this morning. We welcome the Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman is with us. Good morning, Fran. How are you?
Good morning, Joe, and good morning, everybody.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. How are things in sunny Northampton?
Well, I was sort of hoping to wake up to 70 degrees, but that is not true in balmy Northampton. but no, everything is good, and just eager to see what the day provides.
Sort of how we live each day right now, right? Eager to see what the day provides, and then usually bitterly disappointed by the end of it. But that's okay. We'll get
don't
there. It's
anyone.
All right. No, that's right. We won't tell anyone. We welcome Jay Jochnowitz to the show. Editor at large, columnist, editorial writer. He says he's partially retired. I don't know that I believe him. But what is that? Are you really?
Yeah, I have a few days a week that I'm pretty miserable, that I don't do any work at all.
All right, all right.
It's just I haven't figured it out yet. I'm not doing it right.
You sort of half and half.
Yeah.
You have a half, step out of the building and 1 foot still in.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
good
and
for
it's
you.
And it's good. I am getting reading done. That's a good thing, and I'm taking better care of the farm. So that's good.
It's all good.
Yeah.
Jay Jochnowitz is with us, editor at large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, and it's a thrill to have Jay with us. We have a newbie. We have a brand new panelist with us, and we always love welcoming new panelists, especially when. Listen to these creds. This is cool. We have a lecturer of cognitive sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and former Fulbright U.S. scholar to Egypt, Jackie Berry, joins us. Good morning.
Good
How
morning.
Are you?
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Wonderful to have you here. A delight to have you here. Tell us a little bit about the work you do.
Yeah, so I study attention, memory, how we process information, and I do research, and that's a lot of what I also did in Egypt, and I did some here, and I went to Egypt and did it, and I brought it here as well. So I'm having fun. I do eye tracking. It's really a lot of fun.
What is eye tracking?
Right. So a lot of what we can learn about how the brain processes information, we can use by detecting eye movements. And so we have specialized equipment that is attached to the monitor. And so a person is completing some basic task. And as their eyes are moving, we can see what their pupils are doing. We can see how their eyes are moving. And our eyes move a lot. It's something like 3 or 4 times per second.
Wow.
So that can tell us not only attention, but also cognitive load.
And that doesn't make us shifty if our eyes are moving a lot.
Say that again?
I said that doesn't make us shifty if our eyes are moving a lot.
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay. And we obviously, you know, we talk a lot about politics. So, but those realms do bump up against each other.
They do in a way. And so I hope we get to talk about that today.
Excellent. Well, do you have a question?
I am just focused on not moving my eyes now. It's like really...
Fran probably has it best because she's on the phone. So we don't know what her eyes are doing.
Yeah.
She could be napping at this point. We have no idea. So that's good.
Never. I am always happy to see. And I am a former Rensselaer person.
Yes.
So I'm always happy to see Rensselaer people.
Long-time RPI faculty member.
Yeah, so, I used to be VP for research, and then I was professor in the computer science department.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were freed.
and now I'm recovering at UMass. Exactly.
Well, we have a wonderful program today because we have wonderful people on it. We will get to the topics, and just want to remind you that you can be part of our discussion this morning, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to have you be a part of the discussion, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so let's begin. A lot going on in the news, as always is the case, it seems. Some days maybe a little more than others. But here we go. We'll begin with Iran and where we are in this particular situation. And the update this morning is that Israel says that it has killed Iran's intelligence chief. They say this is the latest highest ranking Iranian official targeted in its air war as it escalated attacks in Lebanon that health officials said had killed or injured dozens of people. The Israeli military said in a statement that the Iranian intelligence minister and his ministry had overseen covert operations against Israeli and American targets across the world. Tehran did not immediately comment on the claim. Israel's announcement came a day after it said it had killed Iran's de facto leader, Ali Larijani, whose funeral on Wednesday drew large crowds in Tehran. Early on Wednesday, the Israeli military intensified its attacks on Lebanon, with strikes in Beirut and other major cities, towns, and villages. Israeli warplanes and drones flew low over Lebanon as Israeli troops continued a deeper ground invasion in the south.
Here's what else is happening. At least 1,348 civilians in Iran have been killed since the start of the war, Iran's UN representative has told the Security Council. In Lebanon, health officials said more than 900 have been killed. In Israel, at least 14 people have been killed. The Pentagon says 13 American service members have died since the start of the war. Then we talked about this as it was happening yesterday, so I want to get into it a little bit more fully today, which is the resignation of Joe Kent, the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, who became the first Trump administration official to quit in opposition to the Iran war. President Trump later told reporters in the Oval Office that Mr. Kent was weak on security. Now, you may want to ask, if he was weak on security, why he was chosen to be director of the National Counterterrorism Center. That seems like a fair question, but I digress. We'll get to that later. Mr. Trump lashed out again Tuesday at NATO's allies, who have rebuffed his request for help opening the Strait of Hormuz, a key shipping lane that has been all but closed because of Iranian attacks, sending oil prices surging. He also said that he was not afraid to put U.S. troops on the ground in Iran. Finally, I think this is the one thing that we'll talk about here before I throw it over to our wonderful panel for them to discuss again, we look at the price of oil. Oil prices leapt to around $108 a barrel from $103 earlier this morning after Iranian state media officials reported that airstrikes had hit the South Pars gas field, an offshore deposit that stretches from Qatar toward Iran. While these strikes did not directly affect oil production or processing, they show that oil and gas production facilities are increasingly in play in this war. Natural gas prices in Europe also climb. So there's a lot there to pick and choose from. Jackie, would you like to start us off?
Sure. So for one thing, I mean, I believe that so this is a choke point for oil, obviously. But also one of the issues is this is a digital choke point in the sense that there are a lot of fiber optic cables that are going through to these countries, the UAE, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, for example, these Gulf countries. And a lot of traffic is going there. And so the internet and digital traffic cannot proceed if there is even a small damage to one of the cables. It could be catastrophic. And here's what's really scary about that. India could be affected, according to an article I read in the Indian Times. And also Pakistan is very vulnerable. So this is an issue in the strait because, you know, there could be a big issue with these cables, but also they could have damage from an anchor, from a ship's anchor. And it's not very deep. It's only like 100 meters deep or something like that. So, you know, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, they have invested a lot to communicate with the data centers that they have over there. And I think it's a big issue that, you know, these cables are kind of vulnerable. Someone could even go and intentionally sabotage them. So, yes, we have a choke point for oil. I traveled recently. When I put gas in my car before I left, it cost one price. I came back. I was literally in the air when the war started. And it was $35 more to put oil in my vehicle. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous in terms of, like, how much, how vulnerable the prices are right now.
Vulnerable is a great word because it is, it's just like snapping your fingers and trying to keep track of it is very, very difficult. Jay Jacquemus.
gosh, there is there's a lot to unpack. But the thing that, you know, I'm sure Trump would like everyone to ignore, although he keeps talking about it, is the fact that nobody wants to join his war. And, you know, the biggest, I think the vulnerability, the problem, one of the biggest problems with Donald Trump is really being exposed here. I think his whole life, he has relied on other people to bail him out. I think he fancies himself like the ultimate disruptor in the world, and he will just disrupt things for the sake of disrupting them. I'm going to kidnap a president, and I'm going to tank Cuba's economy, and I'm going to threaten to invade Greenland, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. Other people will fix it. They'll figure it out because the world, he knows this, and I don't think he's wrong on this. The impulse of responsible people in the world is to try to figure it out and smooth it over and make it right. And he comes out looking brilliant in the end, to his at least to his fans. A lot of this, what does work is by accident, often, you know, or by sheer luck. That things do work out. In this case, he's getting a rude awakening. You can't abuse people for really 10 years, the span that he's been a force in politics, and you certainly can't abuse people the way you have abused other nations in the last year and a half by slapping punishing tariffs on them, by threatening an alliance, by threatening invasion, by threatening annexation, by walking away from things, by calling people stupid, by just insulting people right and left, and then say, oh, man, you know, this war, I could really use your help with. Could you put some people
idiot.
In the line
You're
of
weak.
Fire?
I yeah. hate you. Why aren't you helping me?
Right. Exactly.
I don't understand why you're not helping me.
And he'll just move on, right? Like yeah. he'll find a new enemy and he'll just move on, yep. whereas everyone else is stuck, like you said, bailing it out, yeah. right? Bailing him out.
And in this case, unfortunately for him and unfortunately for the rest of us, he can't walk away from this.
Right.
He's got an active war going, or as, right. as the right wing, for some reason, loves to call it, a kinetic war. And whatever that means, I guess it's supposed to
be. I don't
to
know, a, but it's slightly better a, than excursion. But
yeah,
yes.
I guess. and he's got to figure it out, and it's not yeah. going well.
I am so impressed that you're talking about any of this as if it actually makes sense in the real world that we all experience. I'm like, I have so much admiration for that and hope that it will become true. I just wanted to weigh in on something that Jackie said because about the internet and the cabling. And you know, you don't mess with the internet. The internet is critical infrastructure for our world, and literally, much of what we do cannot happen without a robust internet. Now, the internet is certainly, you know, built and managed with some robustness in it, but that cabling is really important. Our satellites are really important, and when we start messing with that. Then really, then it's sort of impossible to do things. I mean, we've all had these experiences where there was just some glitch in a software update, and hospitals shut down, airlines shut down. You know, that's just been happening in the last few years. And so, yeah, you don't really mess with that. You know, Joe, when you were talking, I was just thinking to myself, Joe. You know, you think about Iran, and I have these, you know, three questions. Number one, what is the plan? What's the plan? What is the purpose of this from the United States perspective? And I keep trying to think to myself, what's any possible positive endgame in this? Okay, so where would we get to be to make this worth it? And I have to say, I'm really challenged by that question. I don't really know the answer to that.
No, and I don't know that there's an answer to it. I think that's being worked on as we go. I don't think there's a secret plan in a drawer that gives a guide as to how this is all going to eventually unfold, right?
Yeah.
The I think there are two end goals here that are discernible if he would just, you know, articulate them better and consistently articulate them. One of them is the end of Iran's ability to export terrorism, and the other is the end of Iran's ambitions of developing nuclear weapons. The problem with both of those. With each of those is that to achieve them, you have to do more than what you've done. To end state-sponsored terrorism, you would have to bankrupt the state. And they're not going to be bankrupted. They have oil. They control the strait. When all the dust is settled, Iran is still going to have access to a very healthy income, I think. They're going to have to rebuild a lot of their country, but they're still going to have access to this, and there's still going to be a dictatorship. As somebody pointed out on the show that was on just before us, on the NPR.
Morning Edition?
Morning Edition.
Yes.
They're still going to have, the Revolutionary Guard is still going to have machine guns. That is all you need to keep a population under control, a population that for the most part isn't armed. So they're still going to run this country unless we go in with a ground war and completely defeat them, which we have seen. Even if you achieve that, you may end up, contrary to what Joe Kent thinks, you may end up creating by your own actions, not by Israel's actions or anybody else's actions, but by your actions, you may be creating another ISIS. Highly trained people who are used to making money and used to being in control of things. A Revolutionary Guard without a country to run is going to be a Revolutionary Guard that's looking for a revolution to start somewhere, or an oppression to start somewhere. And as far as the end of the nuclear threat goes, it was mentioned in another story, I think. Are you going to go in and get the material? That's another ground war.
Right.
Yeah, so, it seems to me you're radicalizing another generation.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's a whole generation of people, you know, if you're, when you're bombing schools and you're, you know, you're doing things like this, and then now we have the successor who has lost most of his family and is even more entrenched. I don't see what progress has been made towards... I just don't see what the end game is and how we're moving towards something that's going to lead to more stability. I just don't understand it.
I mean, the one plus for the Trump administration, while they're telling their story, is of going back to Fran's question of the plan, of sort of revising what the plan is that it was to take away any chance that they have to ever make a nuclear weapon again and to kill their military and to kill their munitions. So that seems to have been mostly completed or certainly put a good dent in it. But okay, but it doesn't have a result. It doesn't impact what is happening elsewhere. The problems are still the problems. The issues are still the issues. And that is the one thing that doesn't seem to enter into this discussion enough when it's brought up and the administration gets defensive, very defensive, about how the war is going, because they seem to just want to focus on the air attack and have nothing to do with what is being left, which, of course, not to say, you know, we told you so, but there were of people like Dan Kane and others who said, okay, but this is what's going to happen.
Right.
And that's what happened.
And it did. Yep.
Yeah.
You can't, I've read numerous times, you cannot achieve regime change from the air.
Right. Fran?
No, I was going to agree with you. Sorry, I'm hoarse this morning. I was going to agree with you, and I think that, you know, regime change, culture change, real change, you know, all of that is not sort of a one and done. It takes a lot of planning, a lot of thought, you know, how do you actually do this kind of stuff? And, yeah, I think that's right. You know, just go in, bomb them, you know, move on to the next thing. You know, I think the comment that... you know, it's what was I reading the other day? It was like hit and run, right? You know, disrupt and run. And this notion that, you know, just go make a mess of stuff and, you know, somehow it's going to all be better at the end of it and then go make a mess of something else. You know, we're only, I mean, can you believe this? You know, we're only like a little over a year into this. And think about the world compared to the way the world was a year and a half ago.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of unimaginable to me. And you think about this disruption, you look at the reaction of our European allies, people who have been allies with us for, I don't know, you know, almost a century. who are, you know, people we went through World War II with, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there's no trust. And now, you know, Trump is reaping what he sowed, which is, you know, he's just trying to take this, you know, really immature, inexplicable behavior. And they're saying, no, you know, I don't feel like doing that. We weren't consulted. We can't see what the plan is. We don't know what benefit this is to our populace. You know, so if you think about sort of the direction this is all going, I mean, to me, it's just unimaginable that things have changed so dramatically in such a short period of time.
I keep clicking my heels and I just don't go back.
I'm sorry.
Not getting back. It's like it's that moment when Tim Matheson will appreciate this, when John Belushi
yeah, you know, I was
screams.
Thinking, this is a radio day today for me and for all of you. And I was thinking, you know, what positive benefit can I make for my beloved Joe and the listeners and the rest of you? And, you know, it's just hard to know some days. You know, it's just such a weird time.
You were.
Oh,
I heard just, a Belushi reference.
It was when Bluto says, "Are you with me?" And he runs out of the room and everybody just sits there. He comes back and he does do a Belushi speech. You know, the other thing that has really just struck me in the last few days was Hegseth's one of Hegseth's many news conferences where he just, you know, is berating the press for not being smart enough. And they asked him specifically about the Strait of Hormuz. And I noticed something about him, and Jacqueline probably has a better handle on this than I do, but there's a tell, and I've mentioned this about the White House spokesperson, Carolyn Leavitt. Hegseth has the exact same tell. When he is lying, when he is trying to, when he knows he is trying to, he is saying something that he knows you won't believe because it's not true, but he's going to say it. And you, because you're a journalist, because you're a responsible journalist, you're not going to challenge him on it. You're not going to get into an argument. So he smiles a little. He gets this little twist in his lips and this little glint in his eyes, like, we planned this in the back room.
Like a snidely whiplash kind of thing?
It's not quite. There's no mustache to twirl, but it's a I'm so smart. Look at how smart I'm about to be. And then he'll tell you, we planned this. This is all part of the plan we had. We knew about the Strait of Hormuz. Are you an idiot?
And followed up, and I would like to hear your thoughts on this, but followed up also by that, you know, and what, do you think we're going to tell you?
Right.
Do you think we're going to share this? Even though the president has been truth socialing for the last 17 hours of exactly what I'm not supposed to say?
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you play poker?
I'm not that good.
Okay.
No, my last poker game, I lost a lot of money. Back in college, I had to borrow money to get home.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. We have a panelist on the show that as people are talking, I'm like, man, you would not be good at poker because their face just like contorts as they.
Oh, no.
That's hilarious. So getting back to, I hadn't noticed yet, it hasn't tell. That's very interesting. But getting back to the European, building off of Fran's point, why would they support this, right? I mean, yes, okay, we didn't ask them first. It was unilateral. But also, they're the ones that are going to feel the effects because, by and large, when people are from this region displaced because of war, that's where they go. That's where they end up going. They're not going to probably come to the United States. They have different immigration policies and different social services for people that do come over. And so they're going to end up with the people who are displaced because of this war. And so also, Fran's point, like you mentioned, it's only been a year. But the world is so different now. It feels like dog years in some way.
It does.
It's like dog
it
years.
Does.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just not as cute. we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to sort of talk to all of your points and just spend a few moments talking about the value of alliances and why that usually is a good thing and what we're seeing now and talk a little bit about that.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll also get to those letters and other topics when we continue. But first, the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jackie Berry, Jay Jochnowitz, and Fran Berman make up the panel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. As I said, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the value of alliances. There was a Washington Post piece about just talking what Jackie was just talking about, you know, like, why would these European leaders want to get involved in this? And so, to quote this article, faced with Tehran's successful effort to cut off the flow of oil and gas tankers through a vital shipping choke point, a strategy that has sent global energy prices skyrocketing, Trump has importuned a sweep of nations to help secure the Strait of Hormuz. He has blasted Britain, Germany, Japan, South Korea, and others for their reluctance. And he has revived his longstanding complaints about the NATO Defense Alliance, musing Tuesday that he could rethink the U.S. relationship with allies without congressional approval. This is in between the times where he has his eye on Cuba. But days of demands appear to have yielded little concrete assistance, with countries reluctant to join a conflict Trump unleashed without their input, and one that is deeply unpopular in their countries. European nations are still reeling from Trump's January efforts to wrest Greenland from Danish control, an experience some of them feared would involve a military invasion by the United States. And Trump is increasingly toxic among European voters. That is a line I wanted to focus in a bit on. Trump views it differently, saying that the U.S. came to Europe's aid when Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, but that Europeans are leaving Washington in the lurch in an energy crisis in the Persian Gulf. "We helped with Ukraine and they don't help with Iran," President Trump asked on Tuesday, speaking in the Oval Office alongside the Irish Prime Minister on St. Patrick's Day. "You would have thought they would have said, we'd love to send a couple of minesweepers. It's not a big deal. It doesn't cost very much money," but they didn't do that. So, you know, I think it's very unfair to the United States, not to me, but to the United States of America.
It's very
so, Joe, let me just start with the mathematical inconsistency in this, and then you all can talk about the real world. But it's just inconsistent. We are not in the same situation we were in previous administrations, when there was some interest and actual action in partnership. And so saying, you know, X years ago, when I wasn't in charge, people were willing to work with me on things that could be mutually beneficial. Those things don't apply anymore. Trump has just been the bully on the playground. It's my way or the highway. And so why would those previous actions, those previous relationships, even be relevant to what he's hearing now?
It's a great point, and not for nothing, making the point about 2022, he wasn't president in 2022 when he was working with Ukraine, but that's
I mean, it's
day.
Just yeah. Inconsistent from a mathematical point of view, just saying.
Jay?
It is unfair to him, and I think that's the way he perceives the world, and I think that's really the problem with electing a megalomaniac and a narcissist as president of the United States, that he sees this, he sees himself now, as he put it with Cuba. It was probably the most chilling thing I think I've ever heard him say, or certainly in the top 10. It's always got to be the top 10 because it can't be the most, because there's always something that'll top it, it seems. But when he said with Cuba, "I can do anything I want with it," it's like a toy, a piece of real estate that, you know, what is going on in this man's head?
And not to interrupt, I apologize for interrupting, but just to draw the connection,
almost identically identical to what he said in regards to Cuba. Like, it's there. They're not doing what they should be doing with it. So it's mine.
It's mine. It's mine. I could do so much better with it. And the same thing as Venezuela. You know, I can get their oil out of the ground better than they can. I can run the country better than they can. And I think he, you know, ultimately, I think he may have gone into this thinking he could do the same thing with Iran. But, you know, he is not equipped to run a Middle East country. So that's not going to happen. He's not really equipped to run this country either. You know, what's frustrating, this is a little off topic, but it's very much on point, is that, you know, the Republicans berated Obama and George W. Bush did not do as much damage, arguably, as Trump has done. He didn't do it in 8 years that Trump has done in a year and less than a half. But the Republicans love to berate Obama for going on a world apology tour. I can't imagine the tour that the next president is going to have to go on to fix everything Donald Trump has done to NATO, to just casual friends who aren't part of NATO, to all the other alliances and friendships we've destroyed. And I go back to the fact that he is still fighting over the tariffs with the same people that he wants to come in and help him. And last thing, I'll shut up for a few minutes. The idea that the only consideration with the minesweepers, sending in minesweepers, is that it's not very expensive. These are ships that are going out in the water and looking for things that are going to blow up and hopefully not blow them up in the process. Nature of saying it's not expensive to do that. No, you're just risking people's lives.
You have ships with an explosive material on it and human beings, and you're going through the most dangerous section of the world, and you're like, what do you got to lose? Jack?
Yeah. So Bush also went through and at least tried to sell it. Right. There was an apology tour, but he at least went through the process of there's an imminent danger. There's weapons of mass destruction, and all of that stuff. But, you know, here's someone, in my view, with the archetype of a bully, you know, and an archetype is something that you see repeated over and over again in stories and movies and other entertainment forums. And when you do diplomacy by bullying, you're not looking for alliances. You're looking for cronies, right? You're looking for people who are going to support and back you up and not necessarily be part of the decision-making process. Instead, they're going to support what you decide you want to do.
It is, it's such an interesting point. I want to get to the letters, and then we'll move on to some other things here. We have about 5 or 6 minutes before the top of the break. So I'll read the letters. If anyone wants to respond to anything that anybody says, please just jump in and we'll do it that way. Patricia writes to us and says, during his meeting with Ireland's prime minister yesterday, Trump repeatedly referred to Ireland's president as he. Catherine Connolly has been their president since November. He is so willfully ignorant, it is embarrassing. Does he ever do any work? That from Patricia. Des says, I don't believe
no comment.
That. Yeah. You know, even name tags don't help in a situation like that.
Wow.
Yeah. Would you like to get into the cognitive science of that?
No comment.
Right.
But okay. Take this seriously in the sense that so many people are frustrated. I mean, you can include me in that. By the complete discontinuity between this administration and the others, the kinds of models you expect, the kinds of due diligence you expect, ignore the fact that a lot of us have very different ideas about, you know, how much of a public safety net there should be, or, you know, what level of crime is too much, or, you know, any of those kinds of questions. But You just think about a world where everything just seems random. And, no wonder people are frustrated. You know, why? I mean, that is not at all a surprise. But, you know, what do we do about it is, you know, a really good question.
And so many of the articles that we have referenced over the last week and a half have used that word frustrated. Our allies are frustrated. Yeah. The Congress is frustrated. The Senate is frustrated. The people within the president's own cabinet are frustrated. That it, the electorate is frustrated. So, yes, it's certainly.
I mean, and the real question is, how could so many people, arguably a great majority, be so frustrated and just still somehow let it happen? Right. You know, how does any of us sort of push against the big, you know, ball of whatever and make a dent? And I know we're all trying in our own ways, you know, show up in a frog costume or, you know, or write a letter or, you know, whatever. But it's hard to know what we can do to make an impact that actually improves things.
I told you, Ray, you could wear your frog costume.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's go to this letter from Des, who says, I don't believe this administration is aiming for stability, either at home or abroad. Ongoing chaos creates more room to push through agendas like Project 2025 and others. It also limits accountability. Since most pushback is left to the courts, which can only do so much, in the end, that instability makes it easier for those in power to act with fewer constraints. And that goes a little bit to answering your question, Fran, I think. Let's go to this letter from Catherine. The U.S. is the aggressor, like Russia did to Ukraine. Thank the universe that Europe is saying no.
Yeah, Ukraine's worth a note here, too, that he thinks that everybody should. His reference to Ukraine was, look what we did for Ukraine, and they're not helping us with Iran. We helped them with Ukraine. Well, we did, and we didn't. You know, we went only so far, but he played this game of footsie with Vladimir Putin that, you know, it never was consistent enough that I think Putin saw a real obstacle in his path in terms of the United States, that somehow he could push Donald Trump so far and play him. And he has, you know, from whether it was threatening to withhold arms to Ukraine, to berating the president of Ukraine in public in the White House. I mean, he's never been a consistent friend of Ukraine or Europe in this matter. He's constantly maneuvering and constantly keeping everybody off balance. And that can be good at times. It is not good coming from this guy.
Russ writes and says, as one of your panelists noted, a lot has changed in the last year, and it's important to remember the days when we had a democracy with functioning parties and meaningful public debate as those days recede in our memories. Also, Cecilia writes, the biggest problem with this entire situation is that we are trying to logically construct and deconstruct details as it relates to a completely illogical person. It's scarily pointless. Thanks for the thoughtful discussion. We actually talked the other day. We were having a meeting, and we thought we were going to change the name of the show to Scarily Pointless. but we didn't think
changing
it would sell.
Changing it to Square Table? Or
yeah, that's
table?
Right. Square Hole Round Peg, I think, was the
Polygonal
the other name.
Table? I don't know.
you know, to Fran's point about how, you know, he doesn't seem to have, you know, gone to any trouble to even educate himself on anything. You know, it's a small matter, but I think it's worth pointing out. Yesterday or the day before, he talked about how the straits are actually they're safe to go. The problem is that the oil companies now don't want to do it because they've got these you know, these billion-dollar ships that they don't want to put at risk. And I guess a billion wasn't enough. So in the next sentence, it got up to 2 billion. Some of these are as much as 2 billion. I was like, okay. I have to find out. So I went online to find out how much it would cost to buy an oil tanker. It is nowhere near $1 billion. It was astounding how cheap you can get it. They started about 20-something million for the smaller ones, and they go up maybe to around 120 something million.
You priced out an oil carrier?
I priced an oil tanker. And then you throw the cargo on it, and I don't think you still get anywhere near $1 billion.
So this is what we do with the money if we win our brackets.
Right. I guess so. It's,
okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I got it.
It's great. I want an oil tanker. I'm not driving it through the Strait of Hormuz, though.
I'm going to advance a really wacko, unsubstantiated theory.
So, go for it, friend.
Yeah, okay. And I am not a psychological professional, as all of you know. You know, maybe the guy is just doing the best he can, right? I mean, we all try to do the best we can. We're limited. We're flawed. You know, we're not up to some of the jobs that we have. You know, the question is, like, why are the rest of us okay with that? You know, I mean, okay, he probably can't. Maybe he can't be any better. Maybe he can't be any more thoughtful or less narcissistic or, you know, I don't know. I'm throwing around words I barely understand.
But I feel like,
you know, why are we putting up with it?
Jackie?
Well, I was just going to say, but I feel like respect is very fundamental, and bothering to educate yourself in advance to the point that I think you were making. It's just about, you know, your allies, previous situation, any of it, just bothering to educate yourself and know what it is that you're dealing. That's just basic respect that you should have as a leader, as a global leader. And so I don't see that, right? So doing the best you can, maybe, but I mean, everyone can give respect, right? Everyone
can. I'm with you, Jackie.
Yeah.
And you're not going to convince the oil industry and the shipping industry to do what you want them to do if you don't know the first thing about it and you start making stuff up. I mean, you know, they know their ships don't cost $1 billion. I mean, I'm not minimizing the loss of a $100 million ship or a $40 million ship. But the point is that here's this guy who's telling you everything's okay, trust me. And you don't even, you're just making stuff up as you go along. Mm-hmm. I'm not confident.
We are going to take a break. My thanks to everyone who has written. We'll get to some more letters in just a moment. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We're going to take a break. We'll get news from Ray Graff, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Fran Berman is here, Stuart Rice, honorary chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, lecturer of cognitive sciences at RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and former Fulbright U.S. scholar to Egypt, Jackie Barry, is here, and Jay Jochnowitz, editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union. We welcome you, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. I want to get to a few more letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. We go to Peter, who says Donald Trump has relaxed sanctions on the nation that is providing targeting information to the Iranians that may well have resulted in the deaths and or serious injuries of U.S. soldiers. In any other era, this would most likely result in impeachment, yet the Republicans sit silent as this happens, and Trump's cult members remain faithful. This has revealed the true nature of the current Republican Party. In the real world, this would probably be labeled treason.
The bill of particulars on treason, on impeachment, is so long with this administration. You know, I I'm not saying that flippantly. There have been so many things that qualify as high crimes. And by high crimes, I don't mean felonies. I mean crimes committed by people in high places, which is what kind of the original definition of that was about. The abuse of power that is going on in this administration and the ineptitude and in the exercise of it is breathtaking. And, you know, I don't know what the Democrats are going to do if they get control of the House and enough of the Senate to at least make it worth their time to make an argument for impeachment, how long that bill of particulars would be.
You know, I think it's useful to point out that, the people supporting Trump are not a different species. You know, there are family members, there are, you know, friends, there are the people you run into in the grocery store. And but in my opinion, I think that many of them get their information from different sources, sources that seem just as credible to them, and our sources seem much less credible to them. So you're just sort of swapping, right? You think about where you get your information from, and they're getting information that says, you know, this guy is, you know, doing great things for America. And I think the rubber meets the road when we go to the gas station or we go to the grocery store or we're kicked out of a job or, you know, a bunch of different other things. And so it takes time for us, you know, any of us to be on anything like the same page. But I really thought about this a lot because it's not like this country has two kinds of people. It has one kind of person, but the information, you know, that's due to my beloved, you know, discipline, computer science and technology and all of that. You know, it's very easy for you to get precisely targeted information based on who you want to interact with and what you think and what your preferences are. So I think it just gets complicated by the fact that, you know, we all get very, very tailored sources of information. And some of these sources of information make Trump look like a hero.
It's also dangerous because you can be in like
Very dangerous.
Yeah, and an echo chamber that's just feeding back to you. The algorithm is just feeding back to you what you respond to, what you like to see, what you like. It's to the point now when I'm looking at a post, if I know that I don't want to see seven more of the same thing, I'll scroll faster past it just because, I, you know what I mean? The algorithm picks up on the fact that you sat there for 8 seconds longer than otherwise. And then next thing you know, your feed is completely filled with it. But it's dangerous because people are hearing viewpoints that support themselves only and not realizing that the algorithm is what's feeding them that information. So I guess
right.
My hope
and
is,
not only that, now you add AI to the mix, and it's not even viewpoints that come from people with different belief systems or different information than yours. It's just made up. You know, it looks like Tom Cruise. It looks like the Pope. It looks like Obama. You know, these things aren't real, but how would you know? Because they're very well done.
Yep.
All right, more letters. We go to Thomas, in answer to Fran's question about why would a majority of people endure all this quote-unquote stuff and still vote for Trump. Let me just say, you should ponder the multiple failures over many years of the media, the government, or private sector, and the international community, just to take aim at a few culprits, to address real needs that exist and which need to be fixed. Just as the Democratic Party refused to do a real autopsy of what happened to them in 2016 and 2024, it seems that the only answer that this panel wants to hear is that Trump is bad. Sorry, it's more complex than that. That from Thomas.
I agree with Thomas. I think
I agree. It's much more complex.
Yeah,
than that.
Way more complex.
I think
he's right about that. And by the way, I think the Democratic Party did try to do an autopsy, but, you know, it just seems so darn conventional to me. And the really out of the box solutions that might have made a difference, I didn't see too many of those. But I think they made the attempt.
David, did you want to say something?
No, I don't know that I would put the media in that group, and I am defensive about it because I would say that if you name a problem, the media has covered it. How much attention it got from the reading public or the listening public or the viewing public is a whole nother matter. It is amazing how much work the media has been doing, even under difficult circumstances with declining budgets and staffs and all the, you know, just resources in general. But if I would challenge Thomas to name me an issue that the media has not covered, has not looked at, has not probably done a series on, you know, one paper or another that had the wherewithal to do it. And it's not just the New York Times and the Washington Post or the LA Times or the Wall Street Journal. It's small papers, medium and small papers that are out there and saying, hey, what could we write about? You know, what are the problems in the community and what could we do about it, or what are the national problems? How can we localize this? There's a lot of work being done out there, and I just get a little testy when people throw the media in as the source of problems, as responsible for the problems in this country as Donald Trump is. The guy's the president of the United States.
I think you're right in some ways, but in other ways, and the media is honestly late night, you know, is quite a voice these days. But if you think about, you know, the regular media, they have to run as businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So the problem is there's lots of interesting story. You know, I know a bunch of reporters. They would love to cover those stories. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to be good for the bottom line. And so you're like, for me, it looks like it feels like I read the news every morning. I read the headlines. There's a huge number of things about Trump. There's a huge number of things, you know, talking about, you know, how AI is going to, you know, take over the world, which I do not subscribe to. And that dominates the news cycle for me. And I would like to read about other things. I would like to know more about, you know, what's happening in Liechtenstein, or, you know, what's happening in agriculture.
Really?
Or, you know, you just don't read as much about that stuff in the mainstream press.
You know, I agree entirely with Jay on this idea, because we get letters all the time of, why are you covering this when you could be covering that? And the press is not covering this at all. And then I'll go out and a 4-second search tells me, you know, shows me 97 articles that have been done by major news outlets that cover that story. And I've never, and this, yes, anecdotal, but have never once found, like, oh no, that has never been, you know, that has never been covered. I think that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. It's up to us as to whether we're going to pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, two more letters, and then we'll move on to other stuff. I promise. David is fine. Trump, David says. This letter from David. Trump is so befuddled that he can't see the difference between assisting Ukraine against the aggressor Putin and asking NATO countries to assist his aggression against Iran. Make no mistake, we, the U.S., is the unprovoked attacker in this situation, as it has been called from almost the very beginning, a war of choice. Jeff said, while I firmly believe that the Israeli leadership is guilty of genocide in Gaza and that they certainly see value in this war, I find it patently absurd that the U.S. was goaded into war by them without any of our own objectives. It has been part U.S. defense policy since the early 1990s to come out to take out Iran, both from the perspective of controlling oil resources and the growth of the power of China. Please speak to this issue.
What Obama did with the nuclear deal was he compartmentalized an issue, and a lot of people disagreed with that. And I think Obama took the view that, look, we're not going to get everything resolved. The Iranians have made that clear. We're not going to deal with every issue that we have with Iran in a nuclear treaty. So let's at least get the nuclear development off the table, the nuclear bomb development off the table for a reasonable period of time, 10, 20 years. There was a 10-year time frame, I think. There was a 20-year time frame. And maybe if we can bring them into the community of nations in the world, maybe we can begin to have a more normal relationship, and they can begin to have a more normal relationship with the world. Bit pie in the sky. I don't disagree with that, the view that it probably was ultimately, but you know, we found ways to poke at them. And, you know, it's a constant tension, and so instead, we do the other thing, which is what Trump wants, which I think a lot of other people did, and I think the neocons certainly did in this case, writ large, was let's solve everything, and if we can't solve it with negotiation, which we're not going to, we're going to solve it with a war, and that's what they ended up doing.
Let's move on to other subjects, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. When I say move on to other subjects, I would like to talk a little bit about Joe Kent, which is pretty much on this subject, but a different aspect of it. Chief Petty Officer Shannon Kent was killed in action during a special operations mission in Syria in 2019. Her husband, Joe Kent, said he could not support, quote, sending the next generation off to fight and die in Iran. In his resignation letter on Tuesday, Joe Kent, a top counterterrorism official, criticized the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, but he also mentioned his wife, a Navy linguist who was killed in a suicide bombing in Syria in January of 2019. She was 35 years old. Chief Kent was assigned to Cryptologic Warfare Activity 66, a Navy unit that supports the National Security Agency and Military Special Operations Forces, this reporting from the New York Times. She was supporting the latter at the time of her death. Mr. Kent himself, a retired Army Special Forces officer, recounted meeting his wife in a podcast interview last year. So his announcement yesterday made it very clear that this was certainly part of his why he was resigning and why he was leaving. It was a big part of his resignation letter. What does this overall say, though, about having somebody who had this position, and I said this at the beginning, you're a counterterrorism official, and then you've been named by the president, you leave, and the president said, well, I never liked him anyway because he was soft on terrorism. There was also the moment you talked about the tell earlier, but he seemed like a really nice guy. I really liked him. He was a nice guy. I didn't know him.
Didn't know him very well.
Yes. Yeah, that's always the other really cool thing. But you do wonder, so what does this mean? Does this have any legs when you look at our thoughts about the war in the Middle East and the public's perception of what is happening?
He seemed to almost suggest that this wasn't Trump's fault in any way, that the blunder we have fallen into was entirely the fault of Netanyahu and the allies of Israel in the United States. And I think, as somebody was talking, I think it was Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition when he was talking to his co-author, Kent's co-author on the book about his wife, I think he rightly expressed some skepticism about that and saying, you know, that the president of the United States made this decision, not, you know, to suggest that he was strong-armed into it by somebody is a bit, you know, hard to fathom, and I would tend to agree with that. You know, it's a weird thing because I don't think he's wrong to protest the war. It's just the reasons he's doing it trouble me because he kind of buys into this this discussion that is potentially fraught. And you know, even strong supporters of Israel that I know stress, You do need to make a distinction between the Jewish people and even the people of Israel and the Netanyahu government, the Israeli government. And he's not wrong to say the Israeli government is wrong here to be in this war with the United States, and that the Israeli government wants to do the things it's doing that are counter to what we think should be done in the Middle East. The problem is, and the analogy I came up with was, it's sort of like finding you're having a discussion about the SAVE Act, and you find a Klansman shares your point of view on it, that it shouldn't be approved because it'll disenfranchise white women. And it's like, well, thanks for agreeing with me, but if you could stay on your side of the room, that would be great. And that's sort of what it is. I, 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 you know, his co-author was saying there was nothing anti-Semitic about what he said. And maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. It's just this is a guy with conspiracy theories and all sorts of and the 2020 election myth, stolen election myth. And he's really not blaming Trump for a war that Trump started. He's blaming Israel. So it's both, you know, heartening to see a top national security official say this is a bad war. It's discouraging that it had to be this guy.
Jackie.
or uncomfortable.
So, yeah. So to your point, I do like the idea of distinguishing Netanyahu versus people that live in Israel. I traveled there a couple of years ago, a few years ago now, and not everybody on the ground was a fan. And I would hope this same distinction would be made for those of us in the United States who don't necessarily support everything that our government does. I do think that having linguists are very important. So it is regrettable that her situation ended up the way it did. Arabic is very difficult to learn. I spent many years trying to learn it because you can communicate with people in such a more fundamental way when, you know, I guess the phrase I've heard is when you're speaking to them in your language, you're speaking to their head, but when you speak in their language, you're speaking to their heart. And that just makes such a difference. And so it is, you know, by all means, just regrettable that her situation had to go that way when she was so young.
Fran?
Yeah, I was trying to learn a little bit more when I heard this news about what the National Counterterrorism Center actually does, because I am not so familiar with it. And it turns out that they spend a lot of time analyzing threat intelligence and, you know, monitoring communication and dealing with databases of terrorists and things like that. And in the vein of separating out things, and I really like this notion that the Israeli government, the Israeli people, and the Jewish people are three different entities in some sense, you know, perhaps with different points of view and broad points of view for sure. But, you know, I was thinking about a guy who could, and I don't know much about Kent, but a guy who actually could provide some sort of due diligence and thoughtfulness to the dealing with information associated with a war he doesn't believe in. And I was trying to get my head around, you know, when is it, and I think a lot of people in government are trying to deal with the big question of, you know, when is it important to stay, even if you don't like the way things are being led, because you can do some good, and when can you just not take it anymore, and when is it important to leave? And so I was sort of interested in that question. And I have no idea what the answer is, but was trying to think about, you know, what's going on behind the scenes there.
It's an interesting all the way around of I think, Jay, I mean, you're right. You look at it and you say, oh, well, this, okay. So this is an interesting perspective. And then you look into it deeper and you're like, I like your idea of, yeah, you just, that's a great idea. Just stand over there.
Yeah, and I don't want to draw wrong conclusions about this guy, because, you know, you were in the Middle East, so you know this, that there is more than the United States. While the Republican Party was trying to shut down all the demonstrations that were going on campuses over here that were over the Gaza war, the discussion in Israel is so robust, and so the Israeli people don't agree on this. You know, it's an old saying, you put two rabbis in a room and you'll have three differences of opinion. The disagreement within the Israeli press is really strong too. I don't want to say that he's necessarily, you know, people are branding him an anti-Semite. I don't know that that's the case. I think that's a bit far, and I think the relationship between Trump and Netanyahu, and the relationship that Netanyahu has with Congress is troubling, and clearly plays a role here. But so does every friendship we have is quote unquote influence.
We are out of time for this half hour. We're going to take a break and then go over to the BBC News. We welcome you and your letters. We still have topics to discuss, and we will finish up the last half hour of the show on the other side of the break. All you have to do to join us is to keep your letters short and to the point, and even pre-read them. That's fine. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this. Welcome back to the roundtable. Welcome back to our discussion. Welcome back to the panel. We have a great group this morning. We have some really interesting topics that we have discussed, more interesting topics that we're going to discuss, and we welcome you into the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I know I'm going to screw this up, Fran, but you said something earlier. You said, I don't believe, and I don't want to misquote you, but you said, I don't believe that AI is going to completely destroy the world.
I don't believe it's going to completely take over the world. I'm hopeful that it does not completely destroy the world.
Okay. I was close, but still. you have, there's a...
Aren't you, Joe?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, I think that speaks for a lot of us. But so you have a, there's an article in the Washington Post, and Fran sent this to me, and it's a really interesting article. See which jobs are most threatened by AI and who may be able to adapt. It's the most urgent question about artificial intelligence and one of the hardest to answer. And it is fascinating to take a look at this. It can be depressing or discouraging, but it is something to look at as a tool to see where you fall in all of this. As artificial intelligence becomes more capable, some jobs may remain in demand while others decline. Web designers and secretaries are more at risk than janitors, according to one recent study. So a lot here, Fran. I'm interested in what struck you and what we should take from this information about looking at this picture of not only the idea of being vulnerable to AI, but then that other question of how do you adapt?
Yeah. Thanks for including this. I think this is an issue a lot of people are worried about. And it all comes down to, will AI take my job? And, I mean, that's a question on everybody's mind. And it's not just, will AI take your job? What's AI doing to the economy? What is it doing to our planetary resources? What do we need to know to live in today's world? So this is, and I'm going to up it because we're in a different economy now. It's the $64 billion question, perhaps the $64 trillion question. So the question should always start with, How powerful and what are the risks of AI as a tool? Because AI is a tool. Let me just point out that AI is not a different species. AI is not omniscient. AI is not a being. Despite your experience when you interact with the chatbot, which is trained to respond as humans do. But it's still a mathematical model. It's a large language model. These chatbots are based on, it makes predictions, that's what the outputs are. It is not thinking, it is not feeling, and it does not have a sense of ethics. So when you think about how AI is useful or not, or whether it will replace you for your job, it's really useful to think about what AI can do, what AI cannot do, and what AI shouldn't do. And so if you think about the kinds of things that AI can do well based on the pattern matching abilities of very sophisticated pattern matching abilities of these large language models, they can do analysis for big corpuses of data. So lawyers are using them this way. Astronomers are using them this way. Business people are using them this way to analyze these giant corpuses of data and to make predictions about whatever prompt you give it. Is it intentional? It is not intentional, but it can be very useful because these are large corpuses. It's really useful these days in sort of helping us harmonize things on very different from very different kinds of environments. And so if you think about the kinds of jobs it's really useful for, you can see how jobs that have a lot of this kind of analysis, this kind of triage, and that includes clerks and cashiers and secretaries and bank tellers and security guards, right? Surveillance is replacing security guards, are often really prone to automation. If you think about the kinds of workers who really need empathy or communication skills or creativity, if you think about education, you know, Jackie and I are educators, and for our jobs, AI is fundamentally training things because we can use AI as instructors. Our students are certainly using AI in some sense on their assignments. So it means that we have to figure out how to kind of reset what we're doing based on the positive use of this AI as a tool instead of the negative use. Let me point out that we're also in a transition period about AI. You've heard a lot about Claude and coding. And so Claude is doing a decent job, more than a decent job, of a lot of coding. And senior software engineers are saying things like, you know, I've looked at Claude's code and, you know, I can tinker with it, but, you know, it looks pretty good to me. If we raise a generation of students, and I'll tell you, students in computer science are having a much harder time finding jobs these days, because people are putting AI on the work, you know, if we raise a set of students who don't know how to code in a couple of generations, no one's going to be able to tell if the outputs of AI are correct or not. Mm. And that's a really important thing. Humans have to do the driving, especially for high-risk situations where the code runs a space shuttle or an intensive care unit or some system that we all depend on. It's incredibly important that we have enough expertise to tell whether the outputs we get from these chatbots and these tools are useful for us. So when you think about, will AI take your job, you know, the issue is how much expertise does your job require? How much humanity does your job require? And I don't personally believe, I think as we go through this transition where we're so in love with AI, you know, we want it to make scrambled eggs for us because we are convinced it can do a better job than we can. But I think, you know, once we kind of get used to the capabilities of this tool and the things that it is not capable of, we will adapt with our own expertise and humanity to use it more positively. But now with us all being in love with it, well, not all of us, being in love with us and thinking it'll do everything, you know, it's a dangerous road to go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it, excellent points, Fran, is about being responsible when you're using the AI. So the analogy I like to use is it's a horse. It's a big, shiny, extremely powerful horse, but it is still just a horse, and you have to be in charge and tell it exactly what to do. Because yep. It does not have wisdom, right? It does not have judgment. It does not have, you know, it doesn't understand the nuances of emotion, for example. And so when people think about ways to use AI, when they treat it like it is a, like you said, it's not another species, it's not a coworker, it's more like an assistant or an intern that needs a lot of oversight.
Right.
So I was reading an article, I think it was in the New York Times, about how coding has changed as a result of AI. And I'm no programmer by any means, but I've had to just learn my way around some scripts just to be able to do the things that I do. And, you know, you could spend 3 hours trying to get code to work because you were missing a semicolon. And there went your afternoon, right? As opposed to you ask the code to get, and that you don't have that mistake. And so what's interesting about jobs being creative, one of on the list that was in the Washington Post article, I think it was there was a creative writing position or something like this, a creating writing job that was the idea that artists could actually be replaced is interesting. And one of the points that I read was for coders, this eliminates the drudgery. the finding, the tracking down the semicolon, the making sure that you have all of your loops closed and all of that stuff. Whereas for artists, it takes away the fun part and leaves the drudgery. Now you're responsible for curating it and making sure that it is, you know, realistic. So it has, you know, been trained on models and it can reproduce any artist's work. But now you're left to whether or not this is realistic. So, you know, I'll give an example. I remember, I think this was back when ChatGPT like really first hit the scene in 2023 or something like that. And someone asked it to like make a just make a new Beyonce song or something like that. And it did. And it you know, and it did everything, you know, like the lyrics and the music and the sound and all of that was right. But the problem was it was just some amalgamation of work of hers over the course of the 20 years prior. And we all know that artists have an evolution, right? You know, the way they do their art or their craft is different in 2003 than it is in 2023. And that's the part, that's another thing that AI really misses. So the idea that it can do creative work, to me, it seems like it would be mostly derivative. Because, you know, even listening to the output, you know, like her voice is now different, right? She's older, you know, she's had children. You can hear, you know, like you know, differences in sounds. I do think there are some things that, you know, AI is not going to do well at replacing, it's particularly when it comes to entertainment. But as a as an educator and someone that uses AI daily, it's about curating that relationship and being able to train it to do what you want it to do. But as Fran said, having the oversight to know when it is wrong, to having the oversight to know when that it is hallucinating, because it doesn't know when it's hallucinating. You have to know that it's hallucinating. And you, yes, you can have a whole, you know, generation of students that they don't have that. They don't have that generation. They don't have that wisdom.
Jay? Yeah, I think okay. You're exactly right. And you think about writing, the kind of writing students do, at least, you know, the great majority of students is not, you know, literature, right? Or not yet literature. Some of them, some of them become really our best writers. But if you think about the kind of writing do, you know, it's the sort of thing that it could be replaced by something you get from ChatGPT, right?
Yep.
If I ask, you know, if it doesn't matter the quality of the writing, you know, I need instructions for my new vacuum cleaner, you know, ChatGPT could do a good job if somebody looks at the risk, mm-hmm, right? If it says, you know, dip the plug into water and then plug it into the thing, that's a bad idea. Somebody needs to catch that. But if you want students to learn how to write, they have to go through the same steps that, you know, from time immemorial we've all had to go through. You try to write, you improve it, you keep doing it. It's a muscle to be exercised.
And I've heard, go ahead.
You don't want students, like, not to do that. You don't want students to replace the development of that muscle with something that's just easier, more, you know, time efficient for them. And prevents them from doing the kinds of things they need to do. Sorry, Jackie.
Yeah, no, I was just going to agree with you. Like, you know, I hear stories about how people who, young people who can't tell time. And the reason is because they learned on digital clocks that just give you the information as opposed to an analog clock that shows the relationship between the hands and the hours and the minutes. And so if they are faced with a, you know, typical clock, they don't know really how to tell time. And so there, you know, there's skill loss in that way. Now, maybe it doesn't matter if there's an argument to be made that they're losing the understanding of the inherent relationship between time and space, then it's dangerous. But maybe it doesn't matter. So we have to be careful as educators to make sure that anytime we're assigning or allowing them to use AI, that they're not losing some fundamental skill that, you know, is basically disabling if they don't have that.
Let me just add some really practical things for our listeners, because I think it might be useful for them. First of all, know that AI is not intentional. You have to verify everything AI tells you and verify it independently with actual reputable sources. Number two, never put personal information into AI. We just did an AI literacy and training workshop in the Public Interest Technology Initiative at UMass with Belchertown, which is a local town. And we talked with town employees. And, you know, these folks are public servants. They have public trust. They're really wonderful. And they already know. You never put people's social security numbers or personal information into AI because you need a database or an analysis or, you know, you have to be careful with personal information. It is not private. It can come out in various ways that do not protect the people's privacies. The companies that develop these things all have privacy policies. Much of it does not keep your information private. It's used to train. It's used in ways that beyond what you know. So you have to be careful with that. Also, many people are quite worried about the planetary resources used for AI. And, you know, it's true to train these large language models, which requires supercomputers, months of time, huge amounts of data, huge amounts of energy. That is very taxing on planetary resources. When you think about, you know, everybody using ChatGPT or Claude or DeepSeek or Gemini or whatever you're using, then it starts making a huge difference. It also skews the economy because, you know, only big companies can really afford to provide these services at that level of scale where they're running these models. So if you think about use of it, it would never be one to say don't use it. And in fact, all of us use it all the time. If you do a Google search, if you sign into Netflix and they recommend things to you, mm-hmm. if you're on Amazon, all of these things use AI. So you can avoid AI in your life. But when you use it intentionally, do your due diligence. Be really careful. Don't put in things that are private. Verify everything you get from it. Use it safely. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be a useful tool for you. If you don't use it safely, it won't.
Jay?
Some great points all around. And I love the idea of treating it like an intern or an assistant, that you just can't take it for granted. Just yesterday, we received a note in our emails about mandatory training coming up on AI. That's being done with the Poynter Institute down in St. Petersburg. It's a journalism think tank. And we have to take a couple of these. And one of them is, the first one is AI in Newsrooms 2026. And I guess it's going to talk to us about ways we can use AI. But the follow-up, which is also mandatory, is verifying AI-generated content. My limited experience with AI, I asked it to make a list for me of something, and I knew immediately when I got the list that it wasn't correct, it was incomplete. And I said, this is incomplete. And I found myself talking to it, which was really mm-hmm. kind of interesting. And it apologized. and it was like, it was this just like an intern. This is amazing. It's respectful. It's worried I might, you know, be angry. So
it's
not
worried. It's just copying.
I know. But it was fascinating. We received a notification a few weeks ago about AI as an editing tool and a link to our in-house. We have an in-house AI model that I think is affiliated with ChatGTP, and it did a very nice job of proofreading my editorial, and I was satisfied with it. When the editor who I work with came back, she's an editor at heart, I'm a reporter at heart, so we have two very different feelings about this. Mm-hmm. And she said she was absolutely offended that they even distributed this thing to us, because she said mm-hmm. This is not all editors do. Mm-hmm. And I get that. I'll just say very quickly, Joe and I were talking before the show, and I talked about punching in my occupation and my children's occupations, and I was relieved to find out that my children's occupations, according to the Washington Post tool, were not endangered at all by this, or were at least at low risk. And they're very varied. I have an artist, I have a veterinary, soon-to-be veterinary technician, and a lawyer in the family. So the kids are all safe, apparently. My occupation was more endangered than theirs, which was interesting. And the more I've thought about it over the course of this discussion, the more I realized you have to break it down. what a reporter does and what an editor does, and I, no disrespect to editors, I have been an editor, I work with editors, I love editors, there is a difference. There is more technical craft in what an editor does, I think, at the editing level. We're not talking about story assignments. We're not talking about that kind of thing or the questions an editor asks to a reporter. But what a reporter does, going to meetings, reading tells on people, thinking, not just not just taking what was said at a meeting and transcribing it, and even possibly transcribing it in an interesting and compelling way that, you know, resembles a news story, but knowing what wasn't said, I think, is, and what's missing, what do you need to ask questions about? I don't think AI is necessarily, I'll eat my words someday, ever going to be there.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Hey, if Joe will allow me to make a little tiny plug, I'm going to make a little tiny plug.
Go for it.
Doing a Laura Haas, who is like an amazing computer scientist and former dean of the College of Computer Science at UMass, and I are doing a little series for the public. Yay! Inspired by WAMC and Joe, just saying. Called Talking Tech. We're at UMass downtown, and our next one on May 31st at 6 o'clock is on how to use chatbots safely. So for those of you in the area who are interested in chatbots and using these things safely and responsibly, as Jackie says, come talk with us. It's a discussion, and actually we try to emulate Roundtable as much as possible. So there's my plug.
Very nice. And when is it again?
It's May 31st. In Amherst, Massachusetts at 6 o'clock at UMass, UMass downtown.
That's great. Good for you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that. We have about 2 or 3 minutes, and let me just go. I wanted to very quickly.
Sorry, I lied, Joe. That's March 31st.
March 31st. I was going to say you're out there, but that's good.
I was going to say, yeah, I have my M months confused, but, you know, don't take that to be, you know, my lack of knowledge on AI.
I do not take that at all. Does anyone want to weigh in on the judge reinstating 1,000 Voice of America employees and deeming the wind down illegal, calling Carrie Lake, former Albany broadcaster, Carrie Lake, lack of cooperation.
Hmm? That's the Carrie Lake?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Carrie Lake replaced Chris Capostasi on Channel 13 with Ed Degg, and then Chris Capostasi left and became Chris Jansing on MSNBC, now MS Now.
That's my one-word response to that.
But nine or 10 months she was in the Capital Region before moving back to Arizona. Anyway, 1,000 Voice of America employees. I guess I'm just we don't have very long on this. We only have 2 or 3 minutes. But I'm curious as to like how you resurrect something that's been
decimated.
On hold, decimated and on hold for a better part of a year.
I don't know that you can. I don't think the last chapter's been written on this. I don't think anything is final until the Supreme Court says it's final. And they may argue this is a matter of executive power and they'll take it to the Supreme Court. And whether the Supreme Court accepts the case or not, that'll be either the beginning of the end or the end of the end, or the end of it. If the Supreme Court says we're not going to hear the case, judge was right. Never mind.
We are eager. This is the Voice of America. We are eager to begin repairing the damage Carrie Lake has inflicted on our agency and our colleagues to return to our congressional mandate and to rebuild the trust of the global audience we have been unable to serve for the past year.
Yeah, something like just reading a stat, 410 million people around the world. I mean, this is just such a great service. I mean, it would be fantastic. But like you said, you know, we'll see. We'll see when we see.
Now, did I read that those people, Joe, were kind of still being paid even though they weren't doing their job? So some of them might still be around?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, I think they're literally on the hold. Yes. But again, you then have to go back and sort of create everything all over again after it's been on hold. But we'll see how that works out.
My thanks to a wonderful panel this morning, and thanks to a wonderful audience listening to it. I would very much like to thank Jackie Berry for being with us for the first time, and what a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks.
I hope you'll come back.
I had fun, so I hope I come back.
Excellent.
Also.
Wonderful. Jay and Fran, thank you very much. Always wonderful to have you here.
Always fun.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe, and welcome to Jackie, and everyone have a good day.
Thanks, Fran. Take care of yourself. We will continue with the roundtable in our third hour after this short break.